for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Rage, desire, conformity, and correctness. The characters in Christos Tsolkas' newest novel boil over with their humanness, both in strengths and their all-too-familiar failings. The new book is titled The Slap. It begins when a man who's a guest at an outdoor barbecue strikes another person's child. The Australian award-winning novelist, playwright, and screenwriter joins me in the studio. I want to spell for you his last name. It's T like Tom, S like Sam, I-O-L-K-A-S. It's pronounced Tsolkas. And Christos, it's good to see you.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Diane. Thank you.
We'll invite listeners to join us as well with phone calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook. You can send us a tweet. And Chris, you tell this story from the perspective of eight different characters, and you begin with Hector, who is the man who, with his wife Aisha, is hosting the barbecue. Tell us about Hector.
Hector is a man in his late 30s. He's just about to enter his 40s. I think he has been the pampered son of immigrant parents. He has, his parents have worked really, really hard.
They're Greek.
They're Greek immigrants to Melbourne, Australia. And Hector has a beautiful wife who is a professional. She's a veterinarian. She's an Indian-Australian herself. They have two children. And I think Hector has never really grown up. That's what I think about Hector. And I think Hector embodies some of my own, because I'm his generation, I'm 44, embodies some of my own questioning and concerns about the kind of man I am and the kind of men we are becoming in Australian society.
The whole notion of honour, the notion of faithfulness, the notion of fathering, the notion of friendship, all of that comes into Hector's character. In fact, it comes into everyone's character.
Oh, look, I think the book came out of these conversations that I've been having with my partner, with my family, with friends. Friends' children are now becoming teenagers or young adults. So these discussions about what kind of girls are we producing, what kind of boys are we producing, are part of the conversations we have daily with each other. I have three godchildren. I have lots of nephews and nieces. And I feel I definitely feel a responsibility about how, what kind of care do I provide for this network of people really close to me in my life. It was interesting writing this book because it's eight different characters. And I didn't consciously know this as I was beginning, but when I came to the end of it, I realised that my favourite characters, the characters I had most sympathy for, were the oldest in the book, Manolis, who is approaching the end of his life, and the youngest, the two teenagers. But every other character who is closer to age to myself, I thought, they are very morally compromised. They do not do the honourable thing.
Morally compromised. Now, do you see that as a generational problem simply within Australia, or do you see it worldwide?
I think it is worldwide. I mean, I think one of the things that I love about writing is the specificity of space. And I think I wanted to say something about an Australia that I don't think often gets represented in our literature and our films. you know, an Australia that is made of vastly complicated immigrant cultures. That was one thing that I wanted to do. But I do think it is the themes are universal, if I could use that word, in the sense that for a lot of us, whether you're in the United States, whether you're in Europe, whether you're in a place like Australia, we went through the 90s, very, very similar to here, with the most amazing explosion in wealth. I mean, I think we were the richest we've ever been in human history. But at the same time, what happened in my country, and this is, I'm not sure whether it's exactly the same here, but I think it was, we became the most selfish we've ever been as well. And with all this wealth that was generated, we left nothing behind. We've left no infrastructure. We became unwelcoming to people entering our shores. We became unwelcoming to each other. That's what I discovered and what I felt. And really, I feel that I'm part of that generation that became that. So the slap, I think some of its vigour, if you like, comes from me battling with those questions and battling my own relationship to all this.
Tell me about your parents and why they went to Australia in the first place.
Look, my parents were, my mother was a little girl during World War II. My father was born in 1928. So he was a young child and a teenager during World War II, but there was also a horrific civil war in Greece after World War II. They were born in village rural life. My mother, because she was a girl, received, I think, 3 years of education before she had to work. Dad, because of the interruption of war, had the same. It was actually 3 or 4 years of primary elementary education. But at the same time, they are, like many immigrants, they loved the idea of educating their children. But that's the world they came from. And I'll tell you, Diane, the actual incident in the book is it begins with a slap at this barbecue, as you said at the beginning. And the idea came from an incident that happened at Mum and Dad's. All right, so they were having a barbecue, and it was friends and family, my brother and his kids, my cousins and their kids, my friends, my partner. We were all over there, and Mum was in the kitchen, and in that very Greek way, she was cooking up. I mean, there was pasticcio, there were potatoes, I think there were 3 chickens, Dad was doing meat. It was just this enormous feast. And a couple of friends were there, and their child, Jack, who was only about 3 or 4 at the time, and Jack was going in and out of the cupboards, just upsetting pots and pans, and Mum, getting a little bit flustered, was saying, "Jack, no, no, you know, you must stop, you must stop." And he wasn't listening. And at one point, and it's very hard to do on radio, but at one point, she just took him up and very, very gently, it was nothing aggressive in it, she gave him a little pat on his behind. And I remember this so clearly. He put his hands on his hips and said, "No one has the right to touch my body without my permission." And my mother said, "You naughty, I hit you." We all laughed. I've got to stress to you, there was nothing aggressive in what she did. And compared to, you know, the slaps I got when I was misbehaving, it was a trifle. It was nothing. But going back home in the car afterwards, I thought, isn't that incredible, the changes between my mother's generation and Jack's generation?
Absolutely. Now read for us what you've written.
No. No, 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 no. It was as if the child had become lost in the very word, as if all the world was contained in the screaming of this one negative syllable. No, 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 no. It was Hugo. All of them by now, Hector figured, must know that it could only be Hugo. It was the men who rushed outside, as if the child's screams were somehow connected to the rules of the game, and therefore it was the men who should arbitrate in the dispute. Hugo was awkwardly slamming the bat on the ground. He needed to hold onto it with both hands, but his grip was strong. He would not let it go. Ravi was trying to plead with the little boy. Rocco was frowning behind the wicket. "It's all right, Hugo, you're not out." "He is." Rocco was standing his ground. "He got LBW'd." Ravi smiled at the older boy. "Listen, he doesn't even know what that means." Gary jumped off the veranda and began to walk towards his son. "Come on, Hugo, I'll explain why you're out. No! The same piercing scream. The boy looked as if he was going to hit his father with a bat. Put the bat down now. The boy did not move. Now! There was silence. Hector realised he was holding his breath. You're out, Hugo, you bloody spoil sport. Rocco, at the end of his tether, went to grab the bat from the younger boy. With another scream, Hugo evaded the older boy's hands and then, leaning back, he lifted the bat. Hector froze. He's going to hit him. He's going to belt Rocco with the bat. In the second that it took Hector to release his breath, he saw Ravi jump towards the boys, he heard Gary's furious curse, and he saw Harry push past all of them and grab at Hugo. He lifted the boy up in the air, and in shock, the boy dropped the bat. Let me go, Hugo roared. Harry set him on the ground. The boy's face had gone dark with fury. He raised his foot and kicked wildly into Harry's shin. The speed was coursing through Hector's blood. The hairs on his neck were upright. He saw his cousin's raised arm. It spliced the air. And then he saw the open palm descend and strike the boy. The slap seemed to echo. It cracked the twilight. The little boy looked up at the man in shock. There was a long silence. It was as if he could not comprehend what had just occurred, how the man's actions and the pain he was beginning to feel coincided. The silence broke, the boy's face crumpled, and this time there was no wail. When the tears began to fall, they fell silently.
Christos Tsolkas, he is the author of The Slap. The book is the winner of the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. More on The Slap when we return. If you've just joined us, Christos Tsolkas, who is the author of a new book titled The Slap, winner of the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, is here with me. He is Australian. His family were Greek immigrants to Australia, and he is now writing a novel that has won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Here's our first email. It's from Elizabeth in Peterborough, New Hampshire. She says, slapping even your own child seems a bit much to me, but the real issue seems to be if we as a society should be at all involved in how children are raised and more broadly how we treat each other. Or is it a private matter entirely? I realize the book is fiction, not a discourse on whether or not we have a collective responsibility for social behavior, but would your guest suggest how or if we ought to try to right the wrongs we think we see around us?
That is a great email, and it goes right to the center of what made me write this book. I'd begun the novel in the process of writing it, and then this incident I want to talk about because I think it addresses some of those questions happen. I was on a suburban train in Melbourne. I was heading into downtown, and it was very, very busy because it was, you know, kids going to school, and there was a group of boys, maybe 15 or 16, and they were talking really loudly, and they were cursing, and they were being very sexually explicit. And there was this old lady, I'm not quite sure what her heritage was, but she was sitting there, and it was quite clear to everyone else in that train carriage, or who could see her, that she was getting very agitated and very upset about the language. And I tapped one of the boys on the shoulder, and I said, look, excuse me, mate, some of us don't want to hear that kind of language. And it was the worst thing I could do, Diane. It was obvious, you know what happened next. Their language became even worse. They started, abusing me. I remember getting off, I didn't help the old lady at all. I remember getting off a couple of stations down. I was so humiliated and so angry. I was so furious. That masculine, ego stuff. I really wanted to hurt those boys. That's why I got off. And so I was really furious. But then as I walked in the air and I kind of cleared my head, that anger got overtaken by sadness. And the sadness was, how was it that these boys did not learn what I think is a universal human value, right? That you respect the elders. Unless something is done to you that proves otherwise, that is what so many cultures across the globe grow up with. That's what I grew up with. How have we lost this? And that to me was the central question that it came to me. I thought that's kind of the center of the book, and that dictated how I wrote The Old Gentleman in the book.
Manolius,
yeah.
Speaking of the kind of language you witnessed on this train, the language in your book is rough.
Oh, yep.
It's tough. You know, it's, I read it and I realized you were outlining a certain kind of mentality, a thinking on the part mostly of the men, but the women as well were using four-letter words, every other word practically. And I'm thinking to myself, is this the younger generation around the world? Is this the younger generation in Australia? What is this?
It is the language we use. It is the language we have grown up with. It's the language in our music. It is the language in the books I read from very, very young. The choice of language was very deliberate on two points. One, to get a read a lot yourself to actually ask that question. And also, I think Australian fiction has, and I'm making a broad generalisation, but it's because of the history of Australia, there tends to be a looking towards England, kind of that colonial tie is still very strong there.
The Thornbirds,
and kind of the, sometimes I think that we Australians, we want to write the English novel rather than writing our own novel. Mm-hmm. And one thing I've loved about American literature I've been saying this a lot to speaking here in America, one of the English link, literature I grew up with was American literature. I was reading Carson McCullers, I was reading Norman Mailer, I was reading all those people because they had a vitality that really spoke to me. And then, once I became older and I researched the history of the writers I loved, I realised a lot of them were actually children and grandchildren of immigrants themselves. Mm-hmm. That was what I was responding to. So I wanted something like that for the Australian novel.
Now, in this novel, what happens after that very vivid and loud slap that you just read for us is that these close friends, seemingly close friends, begin to divide.
That's right.
And begin to have opinions, begin to take sides, begin to feel as though Harry did what the child deserved or Harry had absolutely no right to interfere.
I think one of the things to make clear is that it was really exciting to write in these different voices because I was able to explore those very questions that I've got in my head. You know, what what is the right or wrong of a particular situation? I think, excuse me, I'm still fighting the jet lag.
I understand.
That long flight across the Pacific. But the other thing too was actually, I think women and men do talk about these things differently. I think women and men do have different visceral reactions to things to do with childhood and childbearing and relationships to children. I was very fortunate that I work with a group of women who we meet very regularly to challenge each other with our work, and man, did they challenge me. And I think that gave, I really owe them this strong debt, I think, in terms of the women characters. And I became really fascinated. Initially, I wasn't going to write through the perspectives of the three women I chose. I was obviously going to write through a couple of them, but I became fascinated by a trio of friendship that's at the heart of the book between three women.
The mother, Rosie, the child who was slapped,
and Aisha, who is the Hector's partner, and Anouk, who is not married, who is single, who has made very, very different choices from her friends, and I wanted to deal with that as well.
Now, one very apparent factor here is that Hugo, the little boy, is 3.5 years old. He is still nursing at his mother's breast and feels very protected by her, and she feels very protective of him. So the fact that this is the child who is screaming and demanding his own way is still nursing. Why did you create that factor?
I think that came to me because I should make this clear, because I'm a man, obviously, because I don't have children of my own, but I think I've indicated, really proud uncle, an uncle figure. That's really important to me, and because I've worked in literacy and teaching, kind of these questions about kids are vital. I've been shocked by how harsh people can be about mothers and the choices mothers make. I don't know if it's the same in the United States, but every mother, over the last 10 years, my women friends have become mothers, feel this sense of being judged, and particularly by other mothers and by other women, about the choices they're making. So for me, this seemed a really interesting aspect of contemporary life that I wanted to give some texture to Rosie. And because it also exposes the differences between men and women, and also the similarities between men and women when they confront a four-year-old being breastfed by his mother. Now, this is not a book, Diane, about whether breastfeeding at that age is right or wrong. It would not be a very interesting book if it was about that. It's about our reactions to these things. And I think a female critic in Australia said, and I think it was something that made me stop and think about the book I'd written, and that doesn't often happen with criticism. She said what she found fascinating about this book is the different dialogues that men and women have in their heads, and a whole secret language that men have in their heads that she felt as a woman she had never realised. And I think that's true. I think we men do have a secret language, and we have a language that we have learned to make secret as well.
And what you do in this book is to help us understand the internal language that each character is having with him or herself prior to saying outwardly what he or she wishes to say.
Look, one thing, and this comes back to the kind of language in the book, one of the things that I really don't like is pretending that I am outside these concerns, to pretend that this book is about the middle class that expanded in Australia over the 90s and the beginning of this century. And our prejudices and political correctness and all these things and I'm part of that. I am part of this generation, and I have thoughts that disturb me. I try and work out what is the ethical thing to do. And I know often I don't make the right choices. And I think the worst thing a writer can do is put themselves out of that and pretend that the world is divided into people with white hats and people with black hats. That is not the way the world runs.
And there seems to be a fair amount of racial descriptive words. Give me some examples.
Well, look, it's the most prominent, and I don't know if you use it at all in America, is WOG.
No, I had never heard it before,
and WOG
is why I'm asking.
WOG would be the equivalent to the term WOP, I think. So WOG
used about Italians.
I'll be really short because I don't want this to be some history lecture, but for a long time, Australia, as a colonial nation, had a white Australia policy, and only English-speaking people were allowed in as immigrants. That changed with World War II, as it needed to vastly industrialise. And so Southern Europeans and Middle Eastern people slowly came in into Australia, actually huge numbers, and that was my part of that's my parents' history. That's how they came into Australia. Though their first choice, both say, was America, of course.
Was it?
And WOG was that it was you were a Dago, a refo, i.e. refugee, or a WOG. And it was a really insulting term, but I think there is something about the Australian sensibility which is a little... Again, this is a broad generalisation, but there is a laid-backness to what we have. And so what happened with my generation is we appropriated the term. And it is now not at all... this is how we refer to it. Like, my brother will call up and go, come over to my place. I'm going to have a really woggy do, you know. And that's normal. And my Anglo-Australian friends will use the term wog.
Totally appropriated.
Another one that I think in the book is white fella, black fella. Now, the central racist split in my country is between Indigenous people and settler people in Australia, and that we still have not learned how to deal with that fractious history. But white fella, black fella was initially a racist term. Now between myself and Aboriginal friends, we use it all the time.
Christos Tsolkas, his newest novel is titled The Slap. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Much to the disappointment of Hector's mother, Hector is married to a non-Greek, and so that kind of interracial union continues to somehow set people's teeth on edge.
That's true.
That's not just in Australia.
Of course not.
That's all over the place.
Look, it's interesting. And Kula, who's the Hector's mother, keeps referring to, never calls Aisha by her name. She calls her the Indian, or I think Mavraki, which is a Greek derogatory term for a black person. So, you know, that's what, it's scandalous, really, but that's what she does. But it was really interesting. When the book won the Commonwealth Prize, one of the judges was a Zimbabwean woman, lovely woman, and she lives in South Africa now, and she said when she was reading the book, she couldn't help laughing because it reminded her of her great aunt and her great aunt, and whose daughter had married a Greek man, a white Greek man in Africa, and she said she would never ever call him by his name. He was always the Greek. And it's Greek. I think there is those kind of racial tensions and cultural tensions occur everywhere, and I think we become scared about confronting them and dealing with them. And I know there are really positive reasons for why we do that, but then at the same time, I think you can, by doing that, you can also not deal with the realities. You can, and then you are blind to how culture is changing and something more fascinating is happening underneath.
One tiny instant, I once related to our listeners. I was in a parking lot, parking garage in Bethesda, Maryland, and got out of my car and saw a couple get out of their car with two young children, and they were very loud and aggressive in their language. And I saw with my own eyes the mother kick the child, kick the child. And I debated for about 2 seconds what I should do. I walked over to her and I said, "I just saw you kick your child. I hope you'll try to restrain yourself." Whereupon the husband, this big hulking husband, walked over and said, "Don't you dare say anything to my wife. She is a good mother and would never hurt her child." So there you go, Chris. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help families earn it, keep it, save it during Financial Literacy Month, on the web at aecf.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Wilbert Rito went to prison in 1961 at the age of 19 for killing a woman during a bungled bank robbery. Prison changed him. He became the editor-in-chief of the award-winning prison magazine, The Angleite. He was released in 2005. His new memoir is In the Place of Justice. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Wilbur Rito. Join us.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Christos Tsolkas is with me. His last name, by the way, is spelled T like Tom, S like Sam, I-O-L-K-A-S. It's a name of Greek origin. He is from Australia and has just written a book titled The Slap. It's the winner of the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. And if you'd like to join us, we're looking forward to reading your emails, opening the phones. But I gather, Chris, you'd like to comment on the story I just told you.
Yeah, look, it was a very... what I want to say about Diane was talking about a story where she intervened when she saw a mother kick a child. And I think... In a frightening situation, I think it was a very brave thing to do, and I think that's what I think we need to do more often is to intervene. I want to make it clear that this is not a book about, for me, when that man slaps the child, he actually does the wrong thing in the sense that he is what is adulthood but not accepting that you can make choices and that you can control your emotions and your reactions. But it's really interesting. There are actually two slaps in the book, and this is quite conscious, one at the beginning and one at the end. No one ever talks about the last slap because it happens between a mother and her child, and it happens because it comes out of love. And I think the reader understands that. And so the slap goes by. It happens when she's in a situation of such fear about what her child is doing that she has this moment of human reaction. But there's no violence in it. There's no hatred in it. There's no aggression in it. There's no selfishness in it.
And yet, Chris, I have here an article, and this is from Time Magazine, May 3rd issue, titled "The Long-Term Effects of Spanking," talking about physical punishment to a child in the way of spanking, in the way of slapping, saying that studies now indicate that any kind of spanking, slapping, creates a more outrageous behaving child. That it doesn't help the child understand. What it does is to show the child that this is how adults behave.
Look, again, I'm certainly not an expert, as I said before, I've made clear what I feel about what the responsibility of an adult is when it comes with two children. And Diane, I had a really interesting time when I was training to do teaching, that when it came to discussions of discipline, I realised we've lost a language about how to talk about it. Now, we've got a sense that corporal punishment is wrong. It doesn't work. It's part of an outdated mode of behaviour. But I was learning with people who would consider themselves progressive and, you know, liberal and say the right things. And the thing is, they had no language to talk about discipline. They absolutely had nothing they could say, or they were too afraid to open up the discussion. It became bogged down by an inability to argue, screaming and shouting. And I was really actually just talking about it, and I wonder if that didn't have an effect on the writing of this book.
Exactly. All right, let's go to the phones. 800-433-8850. First to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Lois.
Good morning. Yes, I have come. First of all, I'm in my late 70s, and until DNA is done, I'm a WASP, White Angle Protestant. And I have a couple comments here in relation. First of all, I grew up when there was spanking. I saw excessive abuse with my friends, but I do not agree with the idea that you don't ever use corporal punishment. I've seen in the family, including our own, how children get abusive themselves when not disciplined. But the main thing that I called on is I listened to this gentleman in Greek descent. I was reminded that in high school, I was dating briefly a young man. I was in the Detroit area, and I was invited to his house when he was leaving for service, and then later called to his mother when I got a letter, and she made plain to me, and when I went to his house, it was clear that he was second-generation Greek, and she made plain to me that they wanted him to marry a Greek girl. Now, fortunately, he was a wonderful and handsome young man, but I was not terribly enamored, so it was not a big thing. The other two things, and my early exposure to differences living in the suburbs of Detroit, was that my father took in and became friends with an Italian worker whose wife had got left there before the war broke out in Italy. And he befriended him at a time when others in the shop could be derogatory because we were fighting Italy.
Interesting. So all of that history is right there in that microcosm.
It is. It was interesting just listening to the listener, because that's very true. I mean, so many of them growing up, the kind of, it was like you can only see Greek people. You can only marry Greek people and Orthodox people, which of course has begun to change as the culture gets more embedded in Australia. But you asked me about where my parents come from, and as I said, look, you know, my parents had an arranged marriage. They had no choice, and for them to learn the language of choice, which is so integral to American life and I think to Australian life, is like having to learn completely another language. What do you mean you have a rights?
Exactly. What do you mean you have rights? Are they still living?
Yes, they are. Touch wood. And look, I've got to, just to explain to your listeners, they are incredibly wonderful people. And my brother and I, you know, they have been supportive from the get-go with us, but they've had to deal with, you know, the fact that I don't lead a traditional life at all. Like I've been with my partner 25 years, but he's a man. That's a huge confronting thing for a Greek immigrant family. But they have never, ever, ever denied me love. And I think that is the basis, in my experience, of what makes a successful family. I was smacked. Oh, yeah, when I did the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was a bad thing either. In my experience, and it, because it wasn't savage, and it came out of that bedrock of always being loved.
Here's an email from Terry going back to the slap. She says this very thing happened in 1978. I was ill, came outside to sit on the curb to watch my husband wash our camper. One of the neighborhood children wandered over, began playing with our drinking water hose. I asked him to please stop because mud should not be in the drinking water. I said if he liked, he could play with the other hose when my husband finished. The child was 5 years old. He walked up to me and uttered the worst profanities imaginable. I was so shocked, almost delirious from the virus. I did just what I would have done to my own child. I slapped him across the mouth, not very hard. To make a long story short, in about an hour, the police were at my house with the enraged mother. This was the same mother who would lock her children out of her apartment while she serviced her customers. We went to court. I won due to the mother's deplorable behavior in court. In your novel, Chris, the police are called in right away.
I know, over an incident that should be dealt with on the spot, and it should be dealt with adults responsibly. Of course you're going to get angry. Of course if it's your child is slapped, you're going to be furious. But unless it was a violent, you know, senseless and violent attack, I think you can talk, you can negotiate, you can ask for forgiveness. You can explain it to the child as well. In this incident that you just read out, you say to the child, that language is hurtful language. You do not use that language. That's what I did. I forgive me for the reaction, but that was a human reaction because I was so shocked.
Indeed.
And we've lost that's what I mean. We've lost the language of being able to do that with each other.
And to Benton, Kentucky. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane. I wanted to comment. I'll try to get to it quickly.
Surely.
The deterioration of our civil discourse, the anecdote that you told about the mother kicking the child and the reaction that you got, the anecdote that Chris mentioned about the young men on the train behaving poorly. As we've become more and more focused and more preoccupied with political correctness, our society is becoming ever more crude and crass. I just wonder if we've lost this battle. Is this something we just give up on, or what can we do about it? I'd be interested in your thoughts. I'll hang up and let you guys follow up on the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
It would be the biggest mistake to give up on it. And I think the fact that we are having this conversation now says something about the fact that we don't want to give up on it. But it is actually about thinking through responsibility on a more than solely your family level. Like, it's about thinking about what kind of communities do we want? What is my responsibility as an adult across for my neighbours' children and teen, you know, for the whole extended family, for the kind of education we have? For the
How
kind,
about in the U.S. Congress, for example?
Of course. I mean, that's it's about seeing broader than yourself. And that's the selfishness of the generation that I talked about right at the beginning of the interview, my generation, what happened in the 90s and early 21st century is, I think the answer partly lies there as well, kind of in that we became so greedy. I mean, a child, a plasma TV is not important as a code of ethics, you know. And in Australia, I don't know what the situation is here, a plasma TV became much more important than a code of ethics.
All right, let's take a caller here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Mary. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have two things. Number one, I have been in a situation several times in Washington, D.C., where I have observed parents smacking their kids in the grocery store, in the parking lot. And I have said something a couple of times and then been afraid for my life because of the reaction from the parents. So I stopped doing it. But listening to your guest, Chris, I wonder if you could give us any clue as to your opinion about a four-year-old being slapped. Isn't it possible that a big, strong adult could just come over and lift him up and remove him from the situation? I wonder, and this is non-literary, but I wonder what your feeling is about an adult coming over to a little child and smacking him. Do you think that's okay? Can you give me a clue?
That's a really good question, and I think I think as an adult, you don't hit the child. I think there are. I can think of some situations where a child is starting to hurt another child, where you have to be physical to actually disengage them from what they're doing. I mean, I can see that occurrence. But for me, I think I said before, part of being an adult is learning the responsibility of controlling your emotions.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The last thing I did after the father confronted me and said, you know, my wife is a loving mother, or she would never hurt her child, I said quietly to the mother as I walked away, just remember, I saw you kick your child, and left. Now, I hope she thought about that. And maybe in some tiny way, that kind of intervention done in a non-physical way could make a difference. We don't know. I'll never know. But I couldn't not do
what was that?
Nothing.
Yep.
I couldn't. And finally, to Kate, who's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yasu Christo.
Yasu.
I'm of Greek-American descent and just had two very quick points to make. Recently have been looking for some fiction of Greek authors, and I'm very excited to get my hands on your book. I'm 37 years old and been married 11 years and felt the pressure from my parents to marry a Greek Orthodox boy, and got my hands on a Cypriot boy, and that was good enough for them.
I was going to ask if it's good enough. Sometimes that
has not faded from our community yet. And also, when Diane made the comment that the mother was nursing a three-year-old, my thought was, so? I think that there's a lot of judgment, especially mother to mother. And I think the only one, I'm a mother of four now, and the only one that...
Nasuzisune.
I'm sorry?
Nasuzisune.
Oh, the only one that can judge another mother is... No one can judge another mother. The only one who can mother that child is that mother.
But the point is that in the novel, the other women are indeed judging, at least in their own minds.
Indeed. And I think that's... That unfortunately happens a lot, and as I said, it was one of the experiences that really shocked me. Was sometimes the vehemence of the of other women's reactions to choices mothers were making. Now, look, Rosie, the mother in the book, I think she's made some silly choices. I do think that, but I think she really loves Hugo. And I know women who have breastfed their kids till they were 4 or 5, and they are. One of them is my nephew, and he's one of the best young men that you can see in the world. This is, again, not a book about whether the rights and wrongs of feeding to whatever age. It's about our reactions to these questions.
And the book is titled The Slap. Christos Tsolkas is the author. His previous books include Dead Europe, Loaded, and The Jesus Man. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much, Diane.
Good to talk with you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.